Our next case this morning is number 06-2422, Vicki Murphy on behalf of Nathan Murphy against the committee.
May it please the court. I'm Heather Aloy on behalf of appellants Vicki Murphy and her son Nathan, who was 9 years old at the time they applied for need-based Social Security disability benefits due to Nathan's psychiatric impairments. The district court's decision upholding the ALJ's denial of benefits should be reversed. The ALJ's decision was erroneous for two reasons. First, the ALJ called upon Dr. Kessler, an impartial psychologist, to review Nathan's medical records and testify at the hearing. In his decision, the ALJ wholly adopted Dr. Kessler's testimony. However, the ALJ erred in failing to recontact or explain why he did not recontact Dr. Kessler after receiving the evidence Dr. Kessler requested.
I'd like to ask you this. Did Ms. Murphy have a copy of the additional evidence that was submitted to the school after the hearing closed? In other words, did she have an opportunity to respond to the new evidence?
Your Honor, it's not clear. However, it does appear that Mrs. Murphy sent in the evidence from the school directly to the ALJ. The fact sheet says, to ALJ from Nathan Murphy. Can be fairly assumed that Nathan didn't fax it himself. However, Mrs. Murphy and Nathan were represented by counsel at the time of the hearing. Now, Hallux is not binding in this circuit, but it is instructive. Hallux requires the ALJ to proffer evidence to counsel in any case in which the claimant is represented, and there is no evidence in the record that he did so. This was a key error because, obviously, if counsel was aware that this evidence had been provided directly to the ALJ, he could have then taken it upon himself to request the appearance of Dr. Kessler, request interrogatories, or respond even with the brief.
I'm a little mixed up about this because was she at least aware that the ALJ had received the additional materials from the school?
No, Your Honor. I would argue that she's not, aside from assumably a fax transmittal confirmation. The ALJ never responded to her. He never even sent her a letter explaining her rights, whether she could submit a brief or a request for an additional appearance by Dr. Kessler.
Well, for example, did she have to sign a release in order for the records to be transmitted to the ALJ?
No, she did not.
No privacy concerns.
It is really unclear as to who sent it. It can be assumed from the circumstances that it was either the school or some adult figure, but the fax itself says from Nathan Murphy. An 11-year-old child is not going to fax the results to an ALJ, so we really have no idea where it came from. So this poses a problem where the ALJ did not take it upon himself to develop the record when he had already explicitly deferred to Dr. Kessler on the other five areas of functioning. It's entirely unexplained why he did not recontact Dr. Kessler for his opinion on this sixth and crucial functional area. And in the error in doing this is demonstrated by Dr. Kessler's testimony that Nathan did have the second marked impairment in attending to and completing tasks in 1999. It was just debatable as to whether this continued. Now, with two marked impairments, Nathan's disabled. He already had one. In addition, the error in the ALJ's management of this evidence is demonstrated in that he referenced a state agency psychologist finding that Nathan also had a marked impairment in attending to and completing tasks. So based on the combination of Dr. Kessler's testimony and his reference to the state agency psychologist's notation that Nathan had a marked impairment, that makes two marked impairments, and Nathan should be disabled. And while the ALJ explicitly relied on Dr. Kessler's testimony and just considered the state agency report, it demonstrates why the question arose as to whether or not this evidence demonstrated a marked impairment and that this was a very harmful error. It affected the entire disability determination. Now, the commissioner has asserted that the ALJ was perfectly competent to interpret the data himself, regardless of procedural errors, and that's incorrect. First of all, as I mentioned, the ALJ had explicitly deferred to Dr. Kessler regarding all other interpretations of the psychological information in this record, which is actually complex because we have abnormal EEGs, we have neurovegetative disorders, we have a possible impairment on the autism spectrum. It's not a simple case, medically speaking. And here, the Vanderbilt scale is also not as simple as it appears. On the Vanderbilt scale, the ALJ just considered the answers to all questions equally important, and that's incorrect. The only questions that are relevant for inattentive ADHD are numbers 1 through 9. And for a diagnosis of inattentive ADHD of significant levels, the child has to get a score of 2 to 3 on at least 6 of the 1 to 9 questions. Now, Nathan had exactly that. He could have had 7, but the teacher forgot to answer one. So that portion of the test was relevant to the remaining functional area. Now, the Vanderbilt scale is similar to the MMPI, albeit simplified, that if an ALJ reviews the raw answers to each MMPI question, abnormal answers would notify the ALJ of an abnormality, such as, you know, the devil tells me to do something. That would be an indication of an abnormality. But it does not give the ALJ the qualifications to diagnose the psychiatric impairment or determine the functional limitations. You obviously need an expert to interpret the raw data. Here, the same error was made with the Vanderbilt scale. And the significant abnormalities indicated on the face of the test gave the ALJ notice that he should have been consulting a psychological expert, a fact which the ALJ appeared to recognize by consulting the expert for the other functional domains. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Ms. Hennig.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Melinda Hammon for Commissioner Linda McMahon, Acting Commissioner Linda McMahon.
Could I just get one question out? Because I understand your position that Ms. Murphy knew more information was on the way, and presumably she knew she could submit her own information on this topic. But did she have an opportunity to review and respond to the additional materials that were provided by the school after the hearing closed?
I have to agree with opposing counsel that the record does not show us one way or the other. I would also point out that that issue was not briefed before the district court or raised and has been waived. When the ALJ held this hearing and wrote his decision, this case presented a number of issues for him to resolve. The claimant presented evidence of a speech impairment, a mood disorder, learning disability, issues of social adjustment, in addition to this ADHD, attention deficit disorder. But the crucial issues before this court concern only one of those six domains the ALJ had to evaluate, that of attending to and completing tasks. The limited issues now are whether substantial evidence supports the ALJ's finding that the child claimant's functional limits in this domain were less than marked rather than marked, and whether the evidence on this issue was fully and fairly developed. And before we go to attending and completing tasks, I want to highlight that the claimant does not dispute the ALJ's findings in the five other domains of functioning relevant to children's disability and that were rated by the ALJ. She doesn't dispute that the ALJ properly found that Nathan had marked, but not extreme, limitations in interacting and relating to others. And she doesn't dispute that the ALJ properly found that Nathan had less than marked limitation in acquiring and using information and no limitation in any of the other domains. Okay. With regard to development of the record about attending and completing tasks, and the question, why didn't the ALJ call back the medical expert to see this post-hearing evidence It's because the ALJ didn't need to. He had everything he needed to resolve the questions that were raised at the hearing. The ALJ listened to Dr. Kessler's testimony about what kind of additional evidence might support Nathan's claim. He obtained exactly that kind of evidence that the medical expert told him would be helpful. He included it in the record. He discussed it in his decision, and he explained his findings that this new evidence did not warrant a marked limitation in attending and completing tasks. The ALJ got what the expert said was lacking, and he found that it didn't show marked or extreme limitations. Claimant asserts that the ALJ wasn't qualified to weigh this evidence, but was instead required to have the medical expert weigh it. And if this were some medical report beyond the ken of a person without medical training, the claimant's argument might be persuasive. But when we consider the type of evidence at issue here, the argument fails. The evidence consists of two questionnaires that were filled out by the child's teachers that gave the teacher the opportunity to comment on the child's functioning and that gave her a check the box form to fill out to rate in everyday terms the frequency of his ADHD-related behaviors, which were also described in everyday terms. The parties and the ALJ write a lot about this form, but I would urge the court to turn to that page. I think it's 292 and 292A, and actually look at it and see that, on the whole, look at it. It gives the teacher spaces to evaluate, first, how often certain behaviors happen, and second, to evaluate the performance. And the ALJ looked at all these things together, and even looking at the things that plaintiff's counsel concedes relate to his particular type of ADHD, they are not so severe. They are in the middle. He's got problems, and no one ever disputed he had problems. The evidence before the hearing, all the evidence shows the child has attention deficit. He has difficulty attending and completing tasks. The question is, did the ALJ properly evaluate the evidence? The substantial evidence, could a reasonable person look at this and find that the degree of his problems was less than marked, that it was not marked, and marked means this seriously interferes with a child's ability to work, or ability to function in that domain. Okay. Complainant also complains that the ALJ didn't explain why he did not hold another hearing to reexamine Dr. Kessler. But the ALJ unequivocally told claimant's attorney at the hearing that he did not intend to call back the medical expert after he obtained this evidence. After the ALJ and Dr. Kessler discussed exactly what evidence would help, the claimant's attorney asked the ALJ whether the ALJ intended to, quote, to continue the hearing or just complete the hearing and then submit additional evidence. The ALJ answered that he intended to complete the hearing, to obtain the evidence, and then hopefully he would have enough evidence to make a decision. Claimant's attorney didn't object, didn't request that the hearing be continued, or in any way indicate his disagreement with how the ALJ planned to develop the record.
But surely he counsel must have expected that somehow or another he'd be kept in the loop.
The HALEX would provide, the rules the hearing judges use would provide that the evidence would be proffered, and as we've already discussed, A, we can't tell whether or not that happened, and B, plaintiff waived that argument.
Is it fair to say, with respect to this disputed category of difficulty, the evidence is mixed?
Yes, Your Honor. I would think it would even be fair to say that a reasonable person could come out on either side of this. But the fact that it's a close call doesn't mean it's a medical call that the ALJ couldn't make himself. The evidence that an ALJ is supposed to consider with regard to a child's functioning includes medical evidence, but it also includes evidence about the child's day-to-day functioning. The regulations contemplate.
If I'm reading this correctly, I mean, the ALJ did say that he, or note that he got a 7 in difficulty sustaining attention in tasks. Is that correct?
A 7? The form goes up to 4.
I'm looking at page 8 of 8 of the ALJ's handiwork, which is page 33 of the appendix of the blue brief.
Okay. This is on the first paragraph, Your Honor?
That's correct. I must say, I have diagrammed that sentence umpteen times. But it says he was rated at often for 7 of the remaining 9 categories, i.e. fails to give attention to details, difficulty sustaining attention in tasks or activities. Very often in the 2 remaining categories, does not follow through on instructions and fails to finish homework. Now, after you read that, you wonder what was left.
Well, from the form, you can see what was left. You could see that that there were only 2 things he was rated as very often, many of those relevant categories he was rated as often, but not as severe. And also the ALJ noted the teacher's comments at the end there about how he was late with work, but he said he would do it, but left it at home. Although he tended to sit back in class and be reticent to raise his hand, that when the teacher called on him, he was usually on target and understood what was going on.
Is that the whole thing? That's pretty thin read.
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ, there was a lot more in this record. There was the evidence from every year of this child's schooling, evidence from he was getting some resource assistance. He was getting, he was in regular classes most of the day, some years. He was getting special education assistance less than 50% of the day, but he was being continually evaluated. He was in treatment. His parents were getting him medications that helped his symptoms. There was a lot of evidence here.
Yeah, but it all comes down to whether he could stay on task, right?
It all comes down to how often he couldn't stay on task.
This says fails to give attention to details, difficulty sustaining attention in tasks. Does not follow through on instructions.
Those are limitations that were in the whole record. Those were limitations that were recorded in the evidence that the medical expert saw, that he said, yes, this child has attention deficit, but that I can't tell how often it happens. What I need to know is how often does this happen?
And
that the other thing I would point out, Your Honor, is that the medical expert's testimony was not just that there was not enough evidence. He also testified that since the child began treatment after 99, the evidence didn't show enough severity to warrant a rating of marked. So all the evidence up to Exhibit 11F, the medical expert weighed and said, this doesn't show enough severity. So simply having problems in attending and completing tasks doesn't show enough severity. The ALJ went out and found what the medical expert told him to find and looked at it in detail, discussed it in his decision, found that it was not severe enough.
These are the teacher's evaluations that in the paragraph to which I invited your attention, am I correct?
Yes, exactly.
So this is the evidence the medical expert said you'd better get a hold of.
Exactly.
And the ALJ gets a hold of it, reads this, and says, he still is not significantly impaired with respect to his ability to stay on task.
Exactly, Your Honor.
That's the essence of it, isn't it? Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Alloy had how many minutes? She had 3 minutes, and I questioned counsel for a bit, so we're going to make that 4.
Thank you. First, Your Honors, I would like to clarify that the evidence here is not mixed. The commissioner is making the same error in looking at the Vanderbilt scale as the ALJ did. Now, it is only the first 9 questions that are relevant to inattentive ADHD. So on page 292 of the record, if you look, there are only 4 categories, 0, 1, 2, and 3. Now, Nathan has 4 twos and 2 threes. This is enough to signify, according to the Vanderbilt scale, a significant problem with inattentive ADHD. The commissioner again says, well, look at all these other normal responses. He's got all these zeros. Look just below. True. But they're not relevant to inattentive ADHD, which clearly relates to the ability to attend to and complete tasks. They are actually related to what are called comorbid disorders, depression, other types of ADHD, such as hyperactive. So not whether he can complete tasks, but whether he's getting around and running around the room, it's slightly different.
But the critical portion was one that, again, the commissioner and the ALJ do not focus on when they should be. It's tantamount to ignoring an entire line of evidence. So we disagree with their contention that the evidence...
And so even though this isn't any kind of medical or expert-type report, your position as a psychologist should have had an opportunity to look at this and give the view as to how the significance of this.
Yes, Your Honor, because we included the scoring report as well in our brief that was not in the record. It indicates that although this is a relatively simple form, the key is in the interpretation, which a qualified medical expert is able to do, just like the key to the MMPI is in the interpretation, the key to an MRI is in the interpretation. And this court has held in the past that a hunch of a layperson can often be wrong when it comes to looking at medical or psychological evidence. And this is an instance of that, where something that looks relatively simple and benign is not. And, you know, just on the face of this, put the ALJ on notice that, oh, well, there are several twos and threes here. Maybe there is a significant problem, especially since he had already deferred to Dr. Kessler. In addition, the commissioner has discussed that the ALJ said he would just, you know, make a decision. But how can the ALJ decide that there's no need to recontact anyone before seeing the evidence that's received? You would think if the ALJ says, okay, we need extra evidence, that he would have to see that what's in that evidence before deeming it necessary to develop the record further or recontact. The commissioner says the record doesn't indicate whether there was an opportunity to respond one way or the other. We also disagree with that. It's pretty clear that there was no opportunity to respond, even though she may have submitted it. And in addition, it wasn't that Dr. Kessler did not know how often Nathan was having deficiencies in concentration. It's that he wanted more information because a lot of stuff had happened since 1999 when Nathan had a marked impairment.
We do, of course, have a problem that has not been fully noted, I suppose, and that is that the ALJ found Ms. Murphy and the testimony and that of Nathan's stepfather to be not fully credible.
Yes, if I may discuss that. The ALJ's credibility determination was erroneous because it was based on three grounds. The first one is the ALJ said that the financial motive here, may I continue? Financial motive here. The commissioner has conceded that that was inappropriate because SSI is a need-based program and families should not be penalized for seeking need-based awards. So the commissioner has conceded first ground's erroneous. Second ground is the ALJ cited one teacher's comment that he gets along well with his peers. Now, that doesn't make any sense because he had already adopted Dr. Kessler's finding that Nathan has a marked interaction in getting along with others, so it's not really relevant to the issue in question. And there's really no dispute in the record. Nathan's parents didn't say that he was trying to kill his peers like he was trying to kill his siblings. They said he had fewer problems at school. You know, he wasn't breaking his arm beating up his peers. So that's not inconsistent. Then the third ground, that it's inconsistent with the substantial evidence of record, the ALJ didn't cite any evidence in support, didn't point to any specific evidence of record, and the commissioner offers post hoc rationale, which is impermissible.
Ms. Loy, you in response to one of my questions, talked about the substantiality of the evidence. But in looking at your brief here, you raised, first of all, the question of whether or not the ALJ had to recontact the medical expert, and you secondly raised the issue of whether the ALJ was erroneous in saying that Nathan's parents were not entirely credible. Do you really ever raise here the question of whether there is substantial evidence to support the ALJ's view of this matter?
Well, we have argued that the evidence does not support the ALJ's decision. Throughout the brief, we have cited repeated notations throughout his school career that he has had great difficulty attending and completing tasks, and that the ALJ seizes upon a few points of contrary evidence, and as such, the decision is not supported by substantial evidence. You can't just pick and choose a few notations. Nathan has, we noted, how he has had a homework helper, reduced length homework assignments. He has a school counselor assigned to him and has repeated counseling sessions. We've also noted that throughout the teacher reports, even the report that the ALJ relies upon says Nathan's identified ADHD has an adverse effect on his work production. He can be impulsive, needs individual assistance to complete work. There's really no evidence here to support the ALJ's decision that the impairment's less than marked. He's just seizing on things that are not relevant to attention and
I think I have the point. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case.